From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As soon as you first hear the work of Alex Caldiero, you'll wonder where it fits. You could say this is poetry, though Caldiero himself doesn't think that quite gets at it. Sinosopher is the word Caldiero came up with to describe his work. It's also the title of a documentary that explores his art. Part of the film traces his strange journey from Sicily to Brooklyn to Orem. In the film, radio producer Scott Carrier says, "We're pretty lucky he ended up here."
You know, such a strange and unusual person comes to Utah and lives in the most conservative and status quo county in the country.
A few years ago, we spoke with the filmmakers and the sinosopher himself, Alex Caldiero. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting that conversation after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For our purposes right now, let's call Alex Caldiero a poet, though we'll argue about that word as we go along. Caldiero has been performing his poems here in Utah since he arrived here back in 1980. Here's the journey in a nutshell. Sicily until he was 8, Brooklyn until he was 31, when he saw a vision, became a Mormon, and came to settle in Orem, in a subdivision as ordinary as his work is strange and provocative. For Caldiero, his work is about words, but it's also about sound and breath and the moment. The word he's come up with to describe himself is sinosopher. It's also the title of a documentary film that explores his life and his art. This Saturday evening, Ken Sanders Rare Books is hosting a release party for the DVD of the film. The Sinosopher was produced back in 2009, and that's when we spoke with the filmmakers and Alex Caldiero himself. Alex Caldiero is poet and artist in residence at Utah Valley University. His works include, lots of works. They include the book Body, Dreams, Organs, also an audio release, Sound Weave, with the musician Theta Knot. And Alex Caldiero, welcome.
Thank you.
Torben Bernhard is with us, along with Travis Lowe. They are the co-directors of the film. Torben has just – it's called The Sinosopher, by the way. We'll talk more about it as we go. Torben, welcome to you.
Welcome.
And Travis, welcome to you.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Travis and Torben, I wanted to start with you. Where this idea came from, and if I get this right, Torben, you had this – I don't know if it was an epiphany, but you had this idea when you attended one of Alex's concerts a few years ago. Is that about right?
Yeah, it's still a little bit unclear. I'm not sure if my wife had the idea or I had the idea. But we were both – yeah, we were both at a performance. We'd taken – I'd taken Alex's classes for about – I don't know, about 2 years at that point. And yeah, I just felt this obligation – okay, we need to document what he's doing.
But you'd been in his class before. I mean, surely, what was it about the concert that made you think, yeah, we've got to do something with this?
You know, I'm not sure. I guess the best answer I can give to that is that the performance was kind of a culmination of a lot of different ideas in the past. I think the thought had come to me a lot of times, but it had never knocked me over the head and said, you need to get this documentary done. You need to document what he's doing and try to convey to a larger audience what this amazing poet and artist is doing in this area.
So, what was the idea? What exactly did you want to get at with the Caldiero?
You know, originally I didn't really know. It was a matter of trying to just document his performances at first. Okay, I think I was a little bit naive too, to be honest. I thought, okay, well, we'll just kind of whip up a documentary real quickly. My thought process. I thought we need to start filming it, try to learn about his life, try to learn about his works, and then take it from there and try to compile this and make a film out of it. Mm. And really, that was kind of our approach for a long time. I mean, we logged over 100 hours of footage in just a little under 2 years. And so I think that we wanted to have it kind of be a verite thing where we followed him around and didn't try to impose ourselves on the material too much and, you know, just try to collect as much as we could of his performances.
So, Travis, how did it start changing? I mean, how did it start evolving as you were collecting all this stuff?
Well, we started filming and realized it was difficult to transfer Alex's performance into the cinematic medium. So we really had to collect a lot of performances and really try to get at the essence of what he does and figure out how to transfer that onto film in the experience of a theater or in front of a television. So as you see in the film, we kind of manipulate what he's doing. We're still doing justice to what he's doing, but in order to make that transformation, we really change or kind of enhance what he's doing to transfer that.
Visually, you mess with the visuals and sound.
We mess with the visuals and the sound to kind of attack your body a little bit more so you have an experience. Although sometimes, you know, Alex just comes straight through. You know, we filmed him in such proximity that what he does live just really bleeds through the camera. Mm. And so you see that on the film.
So Alex, okay, so people have tried to explain your work and your art before. So why is it that you allow a couple of students? I mean, let's be honest, novices really to try their hand at something so personal for you.
Well, at first it was a matter of like an intuition, feeling an almost immediate confidence about it. And a belief in the beginner's mind. You know, I've always been fascinated with that whole process of the beginner's mind. And in my own work, I've always sought to explore that, of remaining new to whatever you're encountering. So I didn't see it necessarily as a problem, you know, from the get-go.
That they were new.
Yeah.
You liked that idea.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I go, this might work. You know, so that was the thing that, no pun intended, resonated.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as they made the proposal to me, you know.
So how did you see your role in all of this? Travis and Torben, I wanted to get your perspective on this too. Is he a collaborator? Is he the subject? Alex, I have a sense you like to be in control.
Well,
it was a very complex relationship, I think.
Explain it.
It was an extremely complex relationship. You know, I think that Alex is a mentor to us on the project and in school, and he's a collaborator. And sometimes we had to take total control because he was too close.
Yeah.
Sometimes we were too close, and so we'd go to him for advice. It was extremely complex, and Alex was very, very flexible throughout the entire process, and is still, you know, advising us, and as we make some last minute, you know, tweaks with the cut. So it's really, we've been flying by the seat of our pants and figuring it out through, and kind of crashing and then trying to rehabilitate after that. But it's been an interesting collaboration.
I think for Alex too. I think that was at times, I'm sure, extremely, extremely painful to, you know, allow us to do what we thought best, but I think he tried really hard to
allow us to.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because I guess it's a lot of trust.
I think it took a lot of trust, and he said this to us previous, that a lot of times it was allowing us to trespass, and I think that's both scary for him, and I think we felt it as at times a burden and a responsibility for us. To both trespass into his space, into his life, into his art, and try to communicate the essence of what we found there in a way that would pay tribute to him and simultaneously be honest to what we are trying to do too in the documentary.
So how did you want to come off, Alex? Did you have anything in mind?
No, not in terms of – I mean, most of what happens in the film is pretty spontaneous. It's a one-take kind of stuff, you know, so there wasn't any idea of that. My original intent in doing it, and it turned out to be fortuitous that I just celebrated my 60th birthday, was this idea of an examination of conscience, an examination of what I've been doing, of who I am, you know, and the film really fulfills that for me personally. Whatever else it might be, whatever else, how people take it, I don't know. But for me, it was that. So one of the things I put myself into a mindset of being really as candid, as honest, as if I was alone with my priest, you know, and with my God, you know, and opening up my heart and really laying it out, you know, as much as I could, you know, without any reservations, without any. And one of the things I discovered that I had to kind of battle was I realized that I was more of a private person than I ever dreamed that I was.
That I, you know, I had read somewhere where you had said that, and that really surprised me because you seem entirely public.
Yeah, that may be the impression, but in reality, most of my work, or so they made me aware as we're doing the filming, is done in extreme isolation. You know, in my workshop, you know, in my office, in my study, you know, and this really, really came home to me on a level that I didn't realize before.
Which instinct came first for you, the poet and the words part, or was it, you know, the performance part for you?
Yeah, I gotta really admit that they're part of the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to give the obvious thing. It's, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, the chicken came first.
Right.
You know, my body comes first.
Yeah.
My body, my breathing comes before the performance, before the words, before anything else. My presence here on this planet comes before anything else. It's like that.
Yeah. There's this part, and part of the film is you the filmmakers, Torben and Travis, take you back to these really critical parts of your life. They take you back to Sicily. They take you back to Brooklyn. In Sicily, there's this story you tell about how you almost died when you were first born, and breathing for you became somehow important in your work. Breath is being critical. I wanted you to say something about that.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself sort of, as I've grown and developed, that's the common denominator that seems to unite everything that I am, you know, and it was through the film and again examining myself that all of a sudden it connected with this early memory and hearing my father, you know, tell me about this and overhearing him talking about it, you know, and what an incredibly traumatic experience had it been for him. And so it began to kind of remind me, maybe it was a traumatic experience for me.
Yeah.
And so that began a kind of series of remembering, you know, and then all of a sudden what I was doing began to have a deeper sense, you know, and so it was connected. And I feel that it was connected with that difficulty that I had, you know, coming into the body, you know, and becoming awake to this place, you know. And so I think that in many ways that I have not even realized before or am not even realized yet, that those primal experiences still play a role with me.
Torben and Travis, you, there's a lot of space in the film. And there were moments where we hear breath. I mean, that seems an important part of all of this, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think breath is part of the performance. It's part of the experience that everybody goes through when they go and see Alex perform.
Part of the rhythm and part of when Alex is performing, he's actually affecting your body and your breath.
Mm-hmm.
When he's doing something really intense, you kind of tense up and start breathing a little bit more shallow. He'll read like a long, slower poem. It's very like, I think what Alex is doing is affecting your body through sound and through rhythm, you know?
And I also think in many ways the editing that we used kind of mimicked breath as well a lot of times.
I wondered about that.
I mean, some of the most erratic parts, the breath, you know, were your own breath. Would be rapid. The editing becomes rapid, and also we try to let the film sit at times too, and really let things kind of be calm in the moments that they're supposed to be calm, embracing both the silences and also the sounds.
There's this poem where you say, Alex, my own ears need to be reassured of the presence of these creatures of sound. So I wanted you to. It seems like your poems. Do they have to be spoken? Because it seems like in some ways, not always, but they're almost out of context just on the page.
No, because the page is simply another place where they are.
Huh.
You know, and these creatures of sound that I'm referring to as words in a deeper sense. Words have consciousness. Words have histories. Words have genealogies. Words have meanings that we don't even know about. And on the page, it's one thing. On the stage, it's another thing. Hmm. On film, it's another thing. And they're sort of things to relate to and make us understand what we are about. And I view them as living entities in the full sense of that word without trying to sound poetical or metaphorical about it.
Alex taught me something very interesting as a teacher and mentor and me as a student, that he views words on the page as a score, like if you looked at music on a page. And so that he pays attention to spaces between the words and really how you deliver those, how you place them on the page and how you read them and how they come out. It's very related. I never thought about the printed word in that way before.
You know, this question comes up in the film. And it seems to have sort of bedeviled Alex Caldiero throughout his career, and that is, what is he? How do we describe or explain what it is that he does? Let me play a clip from the film. A friend of yours, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, sort of gets at this question. Here is a clip from the film, The Sinosopher.
He won't ever describe himself as a poet. He wants, you know, oh no, he's a word shaker. He's a word sinosopher. He makes up all these things that to define himself, and no one else gets it. And he does this deliberately to his own detriment. Because no one will give him money and prizes and grants. Because, well, you're not a poet. What the hell is he? Well, who knows? Who cares what Alex Caldiero is? He's a force of nature.
So what do you make of that question? Because that seemed an important one. What do we do with this guy?
You know, that was one of the most, I mean, that was a question that we asked almost every single interview we interviewed about 30 people or more for the film. And we decided to focus on about 4 or 5 people. And that was one of our basic questions. What is it that Alex does exactly? And it was also, I think we found, a question that never really got a response. I mean, we asked it to a lot of people, and we rarely got a response. Well, this is exactly what Alex does, and this is what it means.
It was often, go see him. You know, you have to go see him. When I try to explain
him. You got
to
be there.
Yeah, when I try to explain him to my friends, I say, you just have to be in the same room while he's performing, because it's really not poetry. You know, Scott Carrier in the film, or no, it's not actually in the film, part of it, our interview with him, he says, you know, he should be opening up for rock bands. he should fill an amphitheater and have a huge PA and just attack people with sound, you know, like, I think that's close.
Well, Scott says in the film, he's trying to be the thing when he's up there. And he doesn't say what exactly that is, but he's trying to be that truth. Or
sure,
that
sure. And Trent says, you know, what does Trent say? He says
he doesn't read. He
doesn't read a poem. Alex gets up on stage and is the poem.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think that was. I mean, that's been a handicap to us too. I think in explaining the film, it's pretty easy around here with people who have seen Alex perform before, but it's been really difficult for us to be reductive in any way and try to explain exactly what it is that Alex does. People say, so what is your film about? It's about this this guy. He's a no, he's not a poet. He's a he's a sinosopher. And then they draw a blank. Of course, what is a sinosopher? And it's been really hard to explain. And I think our film is an attempt to answer that question, or at least entertain that question and try to get at what it is exactly that Alex does.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with poet?
Oh, nothing at all. Nothing at all. As a matter of fact, it's a venerable term.
You it's know, just
I,
not you.
In the exactly. film, I even contradict myself and at the end say that I wouldn't mind having that on my tombstone.
Right, right.
But then I'd
right.
be dead, right? So there's something dead about the word poet.
Huh.
There's something fixed. There's something that's been made and done with. Something too out there, too objective, too frozen about the word, you know. So I was listening to the Dadas, the Dadasifer, Raoul Hausmann, Dadasifer, right? And that's where Sonosifer came from. Because there was a certain wisdom. It was a Sonosophia, Sophia. There's a certain wisdom, a certain knowledge in sound that you want to access. And I said, I think that's what I think it feels right.
The other thing that's really interesting about the film, and just frankly about Alex's life, is where he settled when he came here, which of course is Orem. And in a subdivision in Orem, there's a great story. I want to play a clip from the film, the filmmaker Trent Harris and another friend trying to sort of make sense of Alex Caldeiro in an Orem subdivision. Here's another clip from the film The Sonosopher.
I have a friend, Evgeny Ufit, who's a Russian experimental filmmaker. Great. And we go to Alex's house, and then we're standing on the steps, and we're looking around at the neighborhood. You know, those kind of cookie-cutter perfect houses, perfect lawns. And Evgeny asked me, he says, why does Alex live here? And I said, because he likes it. And Evgeny goes, he's just eyes got big like that. He says, he is very radical.
Does that explain it? I mean, what? You still live there?
Yeah, very. Yeah.
You feel
that's my home.
Yeah. Do you feel comfortable there? You feel at home there?
Well, you know, I to feel at home and feel comfortable are not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, true.
You know, I go back to Sicily and I'm uncomfortable. I go back to New York and I'm uncomfortable. I go to Brooklyn. I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable right now. But I feel very much at home. I feel very much where I am, where I belong. So being uncomfortable is not necessarily a negative thing. It's a state of understanding and awareness that there are disconnects and there are connects to things.
But did you think about it that way? That is, okay, I'm sort of eccentric, and so I'm going to find a conventional space.
No, not at all. I was planning a family, and I thought that that would be conducive towards that. And you know, I mean, I've never really I didn't go through that planning process. I'm not that organized.
I think that the Alex living in Orem kind of fuels him as well, like. I think that when he performs, it's so outside of people's previous experience that it fuels him. You know, they ask him questions that he might not be asked otherwise, or there's a struggle to be understood where maybe it wouldn't be in a bigger city or something. Like, I think it's as radical in, say, New York City as it is here in Orem, but more people are more shocked by him.
Also, if there's a place that accepts the bizarre and eccentric, I mean, Utah's the place, right?
Yeah.
There's a history of both the bizarre and the eccentric in this area. And I think Alex embraces that. And I think that's also what he embraced in Mormonism and continues to embrace in Mormonism as well.
Well, there's this great moment in the film where you, Alex, you interview him right alongside the Joseph Smith Sphinx in Gilgal Garden, which some of you may be familiar with it. There's this profoundly amazing urban park in Salt Lake City that was created by this extraordinary Mormon mason, Thomas Child, I think is the name. Mm-hmm. And he made a Joseph Smith Sphinx. And you interview him standing next to it. And I have to say, it was the first time I made the connection, Alex, between you and Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith, the seer, this visionary in his time, seen as this kind of strange guy. Is that what connected you?
Very much so. My testimony, if you don't mind me using the word, is based upon that connection. It transcends organization. It transcends religion. It transcends any of the dogmas. It's a very essential kind of connection, you know, with this figure, Joseph Smith, you know, and it's one that continues to, you know, to kind of be meaningful to me.
You talk about him in the film as the coyote figure. You know, you say
trickster.
The trickster, a seer on one hand, but I think you describe him as sort of a charlatan of God.
Yeah, true charlatan of God. You know, Picasso once said that art is the lie that tells the truth, you know? And it's Joseph Smith, for me, was that kind of a person, as Picasso would be. He's the liar that tells the truth. Now, some people have a problem with trying to encapsulate those two ideas and make them coexist and be part of the same idea, you know? But for me, it's a natural.
Was this a hard part of the story, trying to explain Alex Caldeiro as a Mormon?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's... We knew right away that we didn't want to somehow be reductive or belittling and say, oh, look at this weird guy that converted to Mormonism.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's just not true. That's too easy, and it's also not really the story.
Yeah.
And so the challenge was to try to, in a small amount of time, because it wasn't the full focus of the film, it was a part of the film, try to communicate his beliefs and his ups and downs and his complex relationship with Mormonism. And I think we were able to do that successfully because Alex was so candid and because we had this amazing interview with him in which he really laid all his cards on the table. And I know that was, I'm sure, very uncomfortable for him and made him feel very vulnerable. But we also tried to couch it in this larger context where Mormonism is part of something greater. It's part of a greater spirituality that includes his work, that includes his chanting, that includes Sicily, that includes New York. And it's really part of this overarching theme throughout his whole life. You know, we once asked him what his first performance was. And he said it was, well, when I was an altar boy. It was ritual in the Catholic Church. And so it's part of something bigger. It's both unique to itself, I mean, in terms of its story, and in terms of the specific details. But at the same time, it was something that was part of something larger, part of a spirituality that I think is in everything that he does.
That's Travis Lowe and Torben Bernhardt. They're the co-creators of a film called The Sinosopher, Alex Caldeiro in Life in Sound. We spoke with them and Alex Caldeiro back in 2009. Tomorrow evening at 7, Ken Sanders Rare Books is hosting a DVD release party for the film. It's free and open to the public. It's going to include a short performance by Alex Caldeiro. Go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had a few years ago with Alex Caldeiro. He's a poet, sort of, though the word doesn't really describe him. Caldeiro himself prefers the word that he made up for what he does, sinosopher. It's hard to explain, but a documentary film which was produced back in 2009 traces Caldeiro's interesting and strange journey from a village in Sicily to Brooklyn to a subdivision in Orem. When we spoke with Caldeiro back in September of 2009, we were joined by Torben Bernhardt and Travis Lowe. They're the co-creators of a documentary about Caldeiro called The Sinosopher, Alex Caldeiro in Life. Here's an email from Jane, who writes, "As an English teacher in a small town high school, I had Alex come as a resident poet for a day, about 10 years. The first year, he attracted more than 60 kids to his night performance. It was incredible," Jane writes. "Every year after that, students who weren't even in my class would stop me in the hall and say, 'Is that guy coming back?' I'm sure they could hardly believe they were about to say the word poet. They were transfixed," she writes, "when we would come and churn their minds around words. It was a fabulous experience for them. Thanks, Alex."
You're very welcome.
Which sort of leads me to this idea of reaction, and I wanted to ask you about, there's this moment in the film, this is at a performance at Utah Valley University, and it's interesting to see at this moment Alex performing, but what is even more interesting is to see the people reacting to it, which is so intriguing because they're a little disturbed, or they're not sure what to. I mean, what do you make of the that part? You know, the other side of it, how people are reacting to all of this.
You know, I think that's a major part of it. I think that Alex's performances kind of necessitate reactions, responses, and in that you get a lot of different responses. I know myself. I can speak best from my own point of view. I've had a whole range of different emotions at Alex's different performances. I've been scared at times. I've been invigorated. I've been sad. I've been elated. I think I've kind of felt the whole gamut of emotions as I've been at Alex's performances. And I think a lot of people experience that. And I think at first, I think one of the most common things for people to do is to laugh. I mean, nervous laughter, yeah. Not knowing how to respond to something that they've never seen before. And that's one thing that's really interesting I've noticed with our film, too, is that a lot of people don't know when it's appropriate to laugh. Mm. They don't know. I noticed this last weekend that people kind of look to each other for cues. Okay, would this be demeaning if I laugh right now?
Yeah.
Or is this something that is funny and that I should laugh at? And I think people are confused and a lot of times have a really difficult time knowing how to respond to Alex's performance because it is so different and because it is so new to their experience.
And as you see in the film, I think he gets this reaction quite commonly in New York. You know, there's an MC of the event there, and he.
I love that scene.
Yeah.
That's an amazing scene.
Thank you.
He's performing this very abstract thing with a musician named Tom Abbott in New York.
This is in Brooklyn, or in the city anyway, right?
Yes, at the Bowery Club.
Right.
And he's reading there, and it's this extended performance, which we kind of do a montage of, and he finishes, and he's kind of like, thank you. And people are like, pause for a minute, and then they start clapping, and the MC comes up, and she goes, I can't believe – that's not writing. Are you reading that? Like, I want to see that, you know, like, that's not writing. Like, we have a raffle. Like
go, that's what's great. I mean, she's like, okay, get off the stage. We have to do the raffle. Yet she's completely unsure. No, we're talking New York City here, though.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is like where beatnik poets have made a name. And yet here's a woman in the midst of this city completely baffled about what she's seen.
And the Bowery Poetry Club to boot.
Right.
I mean, a place that has a long tradition
history
of poetry.
Precisely.
And she's just completely baffled by him. You're weird. You know, that's not writing. You weren't reading that. And he shows her what he was reading. He was reading a score of his, you know, that words and all kinds of markings to cue him.
It's also, I think it's also important to mention that was the whole day was experimental poets, avant-garde poets. And she really didn't have that reaction with anybody else. Finally,
says, you're the weirdest person here.
Yeah. Finally, Alex gets on stage and, yeah, you're definitely the weirdest weirdest person here.
You know what else, though? There's also a moment of kind of vulnerability with Alex there in that scene where he looks, I have to say, in some ways confused maybe even by her reaction. Or I really wanted to go – I have to say people are going to want to go give you a hug in some ways, because it's such a surreal moment. She's trying to sort of get you off the stage because we've got to do this raffle, and you're trying to sort of absorb them. Maybe you're even
– I think he's playing with her a little bit,
Is that
too.
What it is? Okay.
But I did want to show her, you know, that – see, for me, the book is always a type of verification.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a very meaning. That's why the written. I don't really make that much of a distinction between the written and the spoken. There's like a seamless web between the two. So you thought I was just coming out of the top of my head. No. Look at it. Yeah. Look at it.
And we use that part in the film very purposefully, because I think a lot of people are doubting Alex maybe at that point, saying like, what is he really doing? Like. And you know, of course, the following clips bring up, you know, is this really poetry or is he just playing around?
That's an important question. In fact, let me play another excerpt from the film where this comes up, where you have this idea that is he a stand-up comic? Is this really poetry? Can we really fit him into the club? Mm. You're going to hear Guy Labida of the Utah Arts Council. Sam Rushforth of Utah Valley University and the radio producer Scott Carrier in this clip from The Cynosopher.
I wouldn't name any names, but it was my impression, and I even actually had poets here, established poets here, tell me that they viewed Alex as more of a stand-up comic, that his performances were not poetry.
And I think some of his work is cutting edge and has pushed me into new ways of thinking and seeing, and I think the other half of his work is bullshit.
I think a lot of people watching the film aren't going to understand it. Just like when they go to his performances, they don't understand it, and they don't like it, maybe. They've never seen anything like it. They don't understand why this guy's freaking out or doing, you know, talking in gibberish.
That last clip was from Scott Carrier. Alex Caldier, how do you react to that? That, come on. This is not real. This is, he's putting us on. This is, I mean, how do you react to that? I mean, what do you make of that?
I don't make much of it because I gotta, like, do my thing with it, you know. I can't let anything define me in that way or none define. You see what I mean? The most important thing is to keep it going.
But this idea that it's a gimmick, that this is novel, that you're a ham and this is a shtick and it's not legit or it's not real, it's a novelty. Yeah.
Well, this thing is as old as the caves. This is Paleolithic. You know, that kind of a reaction is very superficial. You know, this thing of the human body, of chanting, of making noises. We review this when we're little children, speaking in babble, speaking these other languages, trying to figure out our own language. You know, so this kind of reaction is, I usually take it as superficial, and it's like a knee-jerk kind of reaction among certain people that, you know, that maybe I'm making them too nervous, you know, and it's a way of dismissing it in their own mind.
If I could be so bold, I would even say that I think that might drive Alex a little bit, and also he's kind of pushing the boundaries of people's conceptions of what performance art is or what poetry is. And so to me, I think it's a signal that he's doing something right. You know what I mean? If he's really trying to progress poetry or progress performance art, I think it's totally natural to have people be like, well, you're not doing poetry. And I think Alex would say, that's fine. You know what I mean? I'm pushing the boundaries of what poetry is supposed to mean and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I think so too. And I think, you know, I really like those parts of the film. And as Alex's friend, you know, and becoming his friend in the process of making this film, you know, it was kind of difficult knowing how he would inevitably feel about those sections, putting them in.
Yeah.
But we knew we had to, because we knew that those opinions are opinions that people have. And those are things that a lot of people who are watching the film are also going to be thinking, and they want to have verbalized. You know, some people go to Alex's performances and sit for maybe 2 minutes and say, wow, that's just weird, and then they dismiss it. There's other people who, I mean, like us, who watched it and then decided to dedicate 2 years of our lives to making a documentary about it. I mean, there's a whole range of feelings and attitudes towards Alex's work, and they all need to be presented, and I'm happy they were presented in the film.
Let me go back to this one of these questions I put to you earlier, which was, did you ever wonder what was real with Alex? Which part of him was an act and which part of him was you know, was an act? Alex, you don't like the word performance.
No, because it has this theatrical kind of background. Sometimes I'm asked, have you taken acting lessons? I don't act. Meaning, I'm not taking on some sort of other role other than who I am. All right? For me, the word act, as far as, for instance, language act, I value the word act in the terms of action, and not in terms of acting. You know the word actor in Greek is hypokritos, hypocrite. You know, so every actor is a hypocrite. He is taking on the words of others, taking on a role that is not his or hers. All right, I hope or try never to do that, and never to try to be hypocritical.
Let me play another clip, because this is again one of those sort of revelatory moments where you see this kind of moment of truth, and Alex seems weary. seems like maybe he's been on the stage too long. I'm not sure, but let me play this at this moment and have you talk about it as we're running out of time. Here's another clip from the film.
I am so Baroque. You understand? I'm so Baroque about everything I do. You know, I exaggerate. You know what I mean? I twist everything. You know, I'm severely flawed. I'm Baroque. You know, I'm Baroque. You know, but so was Bach. Everything is always freaking dramatic in my life. You know, no lukewarm stuff. You understand? No lukewarm stuff. You know, no wonder the Lord says, man, you know, I'd rather you be hot or you be cold. If you're lukewarm, man, I spit you out.
Thorben, what's he getting at there? That seemed like, I have to say, in some ways, one of the most honest moments in the film.
You know, that clip is from an interview that we had late at night that lasted about an hour, hour and a half. And pretty much the whole hour, an hour and a half was like that. Where we were asking the most direct questions, he was giving us the most honest and direct answers. And I remember Alex was crying through it. I look over to my side, and Travis has the shotgun mic pointing at Alex, and he's crying with Alex. And I think what he's getting at is that he is severely flawed, and that he is Baroque in the truest sense of the word, and that's okay, and that's what makes.
To get at your question earlier, what is real and what isn't real? It's all real. They're just different personifications, different levels of real or honest. You know, whether he's joking or crying or being very serious.
That's Travis Lowe and Thorben Bernhardt. They're the co-creators of a film called The Cynosopher, Alex Caldiero in Life in Sound. We spoke with them and Alex Caldiero back in 2009. Tomorrow evening at 7, Ken Sanders Rare Books is hosting a DVD release party for the film. It's free and open to the public. It's going to include a short performance by Alex Caldiero. Go to our website for the details, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.